And today we have a very special guest with us here to talk further about gardening in the West and how it can be easier and more rewarding. So we have Lauren Springer Ogden. And Lauren has worked in public gardens on both sides of the Atlantic before receiving her master's degree in horticulture from Penn State. At the Denver Botanic Gardens, she designed the Water Smart and Romantic Gardens, which probably many of our listeners have been to and would agree with me that they're just fabulous, very inspiring. And an award-winning writer and photographer, Lauren is also the author of many books, probably the best known is The Undaunted Garden, which is has just come out with a revised edition after much work and more photographs and everything that goes into a book. It sounds like it's a whole different book even. So anyone who has the first one may well want to check out the newest edition. And Lauren and her work have also been featured on television and in many publications and books, including the New York Times, Nature, the American Meadow Garden, Garden Designers at Home, Sunset Western Landscaping Book, and The Collector's Garden. Lauren is a popular speaker in the United States and Canada. Lauren and her husband, Scott Ogden design and consult around the country. And they garden together both in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Austin, Texas. So as you can tell by this introduction, our speaker is incredibly well, just well situated to be teaching us about this approach that she is going to talk about, that she uses in her own garden and for clients all over the place, all over the world, literally. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Lauren Springer Ogden. Good morning. Lauren, how are you doing today?
Hi, Ava. I'm great. How are you, Ava?
I'm great, too. Thanks so much for joining us. So I want to start out, as I have with other speakers in this series, by asking you a little bit about how you got your start gardening. What first inspired you? You know, what's your history behind it, the evolution to get to where you are today?
Well, I don't have a real cute story about a really great grandparent or anything like that. My parents both were pretty black-thumbed, they were from Europe and had a very strong love of nature. So I spent most of my summers hiking with them, and so I actually came to horticulture through more of an ecological and natural background. I was more interested in wildflowers and knowing the native trees and things like that long before I actually thought about having my own garden. I did have a lot of houseplants as a kid. I got my first snake plant when I was in second grade for 15 cents. And, you know, anyone who's had a snake plant knows that they pup a lot. So all of a sudden I had 30 of them. So anyway, that was the beginning of a lifelong addiction to houseplants. But that's really, I don't have any really great, tearjerker cute story about any family that taught me how to garden.
I liked that you said earlier on the phone to me that you ruined all your mom's windowsills, all your house.
I did. Every windowsill had something on it, and was really good about, you know, watching the saucers. But you know, I lived back east, and summers were very mild, and so they all went out for summer vacation. So that was a real relief to my mother. So that at least about 4 or 5 months of the year they weren't in the house.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, and then I also wondered or would like for you to share with us about your conditions now where you garden, a little bit about the elevation that you're at, what USDA hardiness zone you're considered to be in, your soils, just a little snapshot of what you deal with right now.
Well, it's actually interesting. Right now, for the last 10 years, I've lived here in town in Fort Collins, which I'm on the west side of town. I'm about a little over 5,000 feet elevation, and we have heavy clay soil, pH of about 8.3, which is pretty intensely alkaline, but I have the richest, deepest soil I've ever had since moving to the west 25 years ago, and we are considered Zone 5B. Sometimes it seems like it's 6 B, and sometimes it seems like it's back to 5A, which is what we were considered till they revised the zones just a couple years ago. But I've lived several places just 15 miles pro flight from each other here in the last 25 years, and it's just amazing, as a lot of people in the West know, that you can just move 15 miles away and you're in a completely different zone and your soil is completely different, and you feel like you've basically driven 500 miles and you really haven't. So I've experienced a lot of very different conditions in the three gardens I've had here in northern Colorado in the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And excuse me, I'm just curious, have you, the conditions that you work with now with the alkalinity and everything that you mentioned, have you found that to be a challenge personally, or have you learned enough at the other places that you've lived that it hasn't really felt challenging to you?
Well, I would say, Ava, there's different challenges with every site, and I'm used to alkalinity now.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten used to that over the last 25 years. I'm thrilled to have deeper soil. I can actually grow really good trees here, and I hadn't been able to do that in my other places. And we don't have as much hail where I am now as I did in my other gardens, but we have a lot worse deer problem. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every place is different. So, and, you know, just gardening in a neighborhood is a kind of a different experience than where I lived prior to this, which was out in the countryside. So there are design challenges that come with having, you know, people living right next door to you rather than having a beautiful open space adjacent to your property.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, thank you for sharing those things about your personal gardening life. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask you some of the questions about your own style that I feel that you have, well, I would say that you have developed, and you can correct me if you're wrong, if I'm wrong, but natural gardening is what you've become known for, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how you would define that, how you describe it, so that people can get a good feel for what that means.
Well, it's a vague word, as is the word sustainable, which is being used a lot these days. And I think the two of them actually interweave a lot and in some ways are almost the same thing. I want to make it clear at the outset that a natural garden isn't the same as a naturalistic garden, because a naturalistic garden refers to actually a style, an aesthetic look, which is where you emulate the look of nature. And a natural garden doesn't necessarily do that. I tend to like to do that in my own personal style. I'm very drawn to gardens that look a lot like nature or idealized versions of nature. But I don't think a person has to follow that model to have a natural garden. You can have a very modern, a very dramatic, even formal garden that follows the idea of what a natural garden is. And to me, it is basically like a lot of the things people think about with sustainability, is that you work with your climate, you get to know your region, you not only work with your climate, not against it, but you also celebrate the aspects of the different seasonal cycles that your climate might have. You know, I didn't even think about those things until I moved to Texas part-time and realized how different their seasons are and how much of it is actually related more on in terms of rainfall rather than whether it's spring, summer, fall, or winter. Another thing about natural gardening is that you consider the animals that are dependent on the plants in your region and the types of animals that do live in your immediate area and how you might support them with your garden. And also a lot less input of extraneous materials, whether it's a lot of soil amendments or a lot of fertilizer, a lot of water, or even a lot of your own physical effort. That's a personal choice how much effort you want to put into your garden. But a natural garden should be something that kind of flows from you and doesn't become a hassle or a ball and chain. And it should also support the animals that are around you. So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Mm-hmm. I think that sounds fabulous. That's exactly the kind of garden I would like to have and help all of my
probably
clients
would you have.
To have. Yeah, somewhat.
What you have.
So I'm curious, I've listened to mine as well, about feeding the wildlife that are natural to the area, and you mentioned that you have deer in your current.
Yeah.
What is your take on that? I mean, do you kind of welcome them in and just know they're a part of the ecology and that's fine, or how? What's your approach with that?
Well, that's a great question because it's a huge conundrum for a lot of people. And I would say that at this point in my career, after 10 years and having a lot of deer pressure here, I finally got to the point where I couldn't have them in my garden anymore. I grew a lot of plants that they didn't eat. They don't eat grasses and sedges, and there are a lot of other plants they're not particularly interested in. So I was really trying to include a lot of other plants that they wouldn't destroy. But they went after my trees, and over a period of time, I felt like I lost 10 years of investment on a lot of plants that I was trialing. And because I do a lot of experimentation in my garden, it really isn't just for me and for fun. It's actually my living in a lot of ways. I felt like I had to fence them out. We just have so much pressure here in this neighborhood. We're right by the river corridor, and we have a band of anywhere from 10 to 15 mule deer that basically live here year-round. And it just got to the point where I felt like I couldn't do what I do anymore in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people, neighbors here, who have gardens, and they welcome the deer in the garden. They actually feed them when it, you know, the wind, there's a lot of snow and things like that, and they seem to be able to coexist with the deer. And I did fine for about 5 or 6 years, but as my trees grew up and the deer population got bigger, and I think they enjoyed my garden more because it became more comfortable to them because there was trees and it felt just more safe than when it was more wide open, they really started taking my trees down.
Well, I also come from an ecological perspective in life, I feel like, as well as into the gardening realm, and I really appreciate that you, you know, held out for so long, because I feel like so many people are just up in arms about the deer and aren't willing to just live alongside them at all, and that you held out for that long, I think is really great.
Well, I also think, Ava, is that we don't have a natural deer population at this point, and that's the issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten worse. We've had two very dry winters here in Fort Collins, and then we had fires this spring, and there's just more and more pressure, and there's more and more deer, and they're not being eaten. And even when I moved here 10 years ago into this neighborhood, there weren't as many, and they weren't here as permanently. And so I do think at some point we have to look at it and say, this isn't necessarily natural, having 13 deer in your backyard 24/7, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing. You want to be helpful to creatures, but you also have to look when nature's not in balance. And I think over large parts of this country, the deer population is way out of whack, and it doesn't even resemble what the deer population was before we settled.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing we have to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. All right. And so, I feel like your explanation of what is natural gardening pretty well explains why anyone would want to have one, because it just sounds like, yeah, we work with nature and we have beautiful gardens and we put a lot less effort and external inputs into it. So I'm sure that's clear to everyone why to try to emulate this technique that Lauren will be teaching us for the rest of the talk today. Can you talk a little bit, Lauren, about the aesthetic and design concepts of a natural garden?
Well, certainly I can. Again, I want to make sure people don't think that there is actually any kind of a limited aesthetic, because it isn't actually naturalistic. So it's not about emulating nature visually. And so I would say, you know, the aesthetics are very much still up to the person's own taste. And like I said, me personally, I am moved by natural plant communities and the local stone. And I want something in my garden that expresses that and in some ways actually vivifies and intensifies the experience of what I find beautiful in nature. but not everyone else might want to do that. And sometimes your garden's too small to have something. Like, for instance, I have a big prairie garden, and I have a big short grass prairie garden as well, which is I call it the step garden. And they would look really unnatural in a really tiny space. It's something you have to actually be able to look over and perceive from a distance to really get the feel of serenity from them. Otherwise, they look kind of like a scruffy patch of grass if you look at them up close and personally. So again, it's very variable in terms of aesthetics. But some basic things about just the concept of designing a natural garden would be that there aren't a whole lot of rules, again, except choosing plants that you like and also like your conditions. But really getting to know plants is a big part of actually creating a natural garden. You know, obviously you should fall in love with them and want them in your garden, but knowing, you know, what they do in terms of how they can feed the animals, but also what are their strong points, what it draws you to them, and then when you get to know them, you might also find they have certain negatives, and you want to find ways of placing them in the garden and using them that will minimize those negative points. Like if they're extremely thorny or they drop little prickly leaves like mahonias or things, you would place them in a way that you would appreciate them and love them, but they wouldn't necessarily have daily encounters with them physically, that kind of thing. So that's what I'm talking about, really getting to know your plants and their ups and downs and what you love about them and what you don't love so much. And the other thing I would say otherwise would be that a natural garden is like nature in that when plants are well adjusted to the conditions you have, they will naturally reproduce either by seed, or they'll get wider and wider and you can get, you know, babies off them vegetatively, or they just grow very well. And it's nice to see that in the garden and feel like you've done well by these plants, but also then to think, well, maybe I need a few more of them. The idea of just having one of each is really kind of against the idea of a natural garden. We all love plants and we want to have lots of them, but I think a one of each collection can never really be a natural garden. When you have a garden and you start to get a sense of what really is very, very at home in your soil and your climate, pick your favorite ones that are doing really well and start spreading them around the garden and add more, and then you get the sense of a plant community, because that's how it is in nature. There's very rarely one of this and one of that. There's usually clusters of things, and sometimes even one plant will dominate, and a gardener has to decide whether they're going to allow that to happen or whether they want to referee and make sure that one plant doesn't run the show. But again, just if you have happy plants, have more of those happy plants. And then I guess finally would be using different types of plants in terms of, obviously, if you have a sunny, dry garden, you're going to look at plants that thrive in that kind of condition. But think about plants that have appeal over different times of the year and have their spurts of growth in terms of a time-lapse thing over a year and also over, you know, a decade or two decades. And consider that when you create a garden and layer it with plants. So you have plants that come up early in the spring like bulbs and nothing else is happening. Then you have plants that will cover up those bulbs as they go dormant. You have trees that grow up over plants that like being in an understory. So the more layers you have, the more diversity is possible, the more interesting your garden is, and also the more animals can make use of your garden. And that's basically it.
Great. That's a lot to think about. And I'm sure I will enjoy walking out into my garden with these concepts percolating through and, you know, look at what could be changed out or how I could do things differently. And I imagine many of our listeners will be doing the same. So good things to think about.
Well, it is a process, as most gardeners know. And it's not like your garden is necessarily going to be everything you want it to be the first year you put it in. And, you know, after 10 years, I'm finding that there are lots of areas of my garden now that I'd like to rework because certain plants have muscled out other plants and I'd like to have more of another plant again or a little less of that plant. And in some cases, it means actually taking areas and actually starting from scratch in certain parts. So it really is a process. I have certain parts of my prairie I'm going to redo after 10 years. And, you know, for about a 20 by 20 foot area, we're going to actually tear out about probably 50% of the plants and put different plants in next year.
Wow.
So it's never done.
Yeah.
So.
It would be boring if it was.
Yep. True.
Okay. Well, before we move on to kind of the more how-to section of our talk today, I'd like to just touch on a question I have concerning design and the fact that you mentioned that a natural garden could be formal in character. And so I'm kind of wondering how you would explain how that would work. I mean, would that just look like all native plants, or what would be natural about it if it wasn't mimicking nature but rather conforming to a formal sort of design?
Well, I think certain plants have a natural formality about their form. Like take the Taylor juniper, for instance, that very extremely upright, narrow, and tight selection of juniper that's now available in many of the places, the nurseries around the Front Range and other parts of the West. That is a natural plant. It does not need to be sheared to look like that, but it looks like an Italian cypress, which is also a naturally unmessed with plant that has a very formal appearance. And you can use a plant like that in a garden. You can actually make a hedge of those with plants in the foreground, you know, that may have fruits or whatever, other kinds of fruits. The Taylor juniper is actually a female selection, so it does make fruits, which is kind of nice. I like to have berry junipers rather than the male selections that don't have the fruit. But anyhow, so you can choose plants that have a natural formality about their form, and then you can also take plants that aren't necessarily naturally formal in their form, but place them in a formal manner. And that doesn't make a garden less natural. If you still have diversity and you still have plants that are well adapted and then don't need to be constantly helped to live and survive and thrive, and plants that offer something for creatures. So it really doesn't matter if they're grown in a straight line or if you're creating an edge of a square patio or you're doing a formal alley of Taylor junipers to block out your neighbors. That doesn't mean it's not a natural garden. There are still birds roosting in those Taylor junipers. They still don't need hardly any water beyond what we get from natural rainfall, and the birds are eating the fruit, and they look great. So that's kind of what I'm trying to say. It's really not about the shape of the garden and how the plants are laid out, or even what particular plants you choose, whether they're more formal looking or more floppy or more airy or you know, amorphous looking. It's really more about choosing plants that work in our climate, that do well in your particular situation, and having lots of different types of plants that will help the animals.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that clears it up really well for me, and I appreciate you going into that little kind of side point. Yeah, that's
sure.
Great. So, yeah, then on to practical aspects of creating and stewarding a natural garden. I'm very interested in this part of the talk because I feel like this really is the how-to and the bare bones. You've captured our imaginations with what can be, and it's sort of like sugar plum fairies dancing in my head right now, and I think it's super great. So give us some pointers on how we can get there.
Well, a lot of it is really common sense, Eva, but I would say that a lot of it very much dovetails again with the idea of sustainability. And there are going to be some things here that I have done that work for me that other gardeners may not agree with. You know, I always find I have a lot of good friends in the business, and there are certain things we often argue about. Horticulture isn't an exact science. Gardening is not an exact art. There's just so much interpretation in both the art and science of growing plants, and what works for one person may not work for another, but I'm going to give you what has worked for me for the last 30 years, and I've refined it. I did some things differently even 10 years ago than I do now, but a lot of it is based on the idea, again, of minimal input, and then also that your garden doesn't put out too much, and that's often people don't think about that aspect. A lot of people think about, yeah, I don't want to have to bring in all kinds of soil. I don't want to have to bring in all kinds of amendments. I don't want to have to fertilize everything regularly, even if it's organic fertilizers, but certainly not the petroleum-based ones. And I don't want to have to water all the time, and I'd like to minimize my water use, and when I use it, I'd like to use it wisely. Those are things I think most people are really thinking about in the West who are serious gardeners. But there's some things you can think about that aren't so obvious, and it's like, where do you get your plants from? Who's growing a lot of well-adapted plants? Where can you get them? Are there local nurseries, regional nurseries, mail-order nurseries that you know are growing plants that are really ideal for the West or even ideal for your particular part of the West? Are they really pushing the envelope on propagating a lot of our regional natives? And are they growing them in smaller sizes? Or do you always have to buy a big plastic 5-gallon pot with, you know, 5 pounds of potting soil in it every time you buy a plant? Because that's something, not only do we not always want to dig a huge hole for something, but you know, you're bringing in a lot of extraneous materials that were harvested elsewhere, were manufactured elsewhere, using materials that were came from somewhere else. So all those kinds of things. And I also find that my plants transition best when I even remove most of the potting soil from the root ball anyway. I want them to realize that real life in my garden is clay, and the sooner they figure that out, the better off they are. Otherwise, if they're whirling around in their magical kingdom of pea for the next 5 years, you're going to basically have a tree or a shrub or even a perennial that's not going to grow very well or make use of the water that's being held in the clay around it if it's too busy being happy in its perfect little peat pocket. So that's the other thing. So small size containers if you can. And then I would say, you know, again, if you can find them at places locally, regionally, or from mail order nurseries that really are doing great things with plants that are adapted to our region. And then, again, the potting soil isn't going to help your plant or the garden in the long run, especially if your soil is very different from it. Most Western soils are pretty far removed from potting soil. And then I like to plant when plants are actually spending more of their energies putting out roots and storing carbohydrates than when they're trying to grow tops, and that would be late summer and fall. Mm-hmm. And so I've always tried to, if I can, keep some of my larger planting projects for that time of year, because in the spring, especially in many parts of the West, we kind of jump from winter to summer, and we don't have a long period of really temperate climates. It gets hot, it gets windy, we go into drought often very quickly, with no rains for 6 to 8 weeks sometimes. We have hailstorms. Things are much gentler in many parts of the West with the onset of monsoon, and just the cooler nights and the sun being a little lower angled. And the plants are actually biologically putting out roots at that time of year and not trying to grow tops at the same time. So you put a baby plant in May, and it is trying to grow roots and establish at the same time it's trying to grow tops. And that's a lot more stressful than a plant that's already grown its top for the season in late August or early September and can just worry about getting its roots out. And so that's another way of not having to constantly water your plants as much to get them established, and getting them established in a way that you'd be surprised in the spring how much bigger that plant will be, because it's actually done an amazing amount of root growth in the fall and even into the winter before it reemerges in the spring with active growth. So that's another thing. Make it easy on the plant and on yourself. The downside of planting later in the season is that some of your favorite plants may already be sold out. And so that's always the conundrum. There are certain things that you can't get unless you're, you know, first in line on May 1st or whatever at the nursery. But they're an amazing amount of plants, and often also at a reduced price. And often also what I call pre-torture. They've been in the nursery all summer and they're looking kind of tired. Those plants are often the plants that are best to get in the garden, because they are actually primed to actually have a better situation than what they've had, you know, melting in their little black pots on the bench in the nursery all summer long. Mm-hmm. So that would be that. I have several other ideas, but you may have something to say at this point. I feel like I'm going on and on and on.
No, it's good. We want you to go on. First, I want to ask you about planting late summer and fall. That makes perfect sense. And people always ask me, well, how late can you plant? So, you know, the
line a lot of the nurseries, so I feel like as long as the ground isn't frozen, you can plant. But then I've been learning that there are exceptions to that, like your more deserty plants and South African plants. So can you give us any guidelines, rules of thumb on that issue?
Well, I totally agree with you, Ava. My experience has been southwestern native plants, a lot of plants that are naturally geared to late summer rains, monsoon. A lot of those plants, if you plant them way too late, they don't go dormant quickly enough, and they actually can be winter injured because they're still in active growth at the nursery, whereas other plants naturally have a timetable that they are slowing down later in the season because they don't come from places that have late season rains. The other thing is a lot of the warm season grasses actually stop growing once the temperatures get cooler, and that means their root growth also ceases. Grasses are different, monocots are different from dicots, grasses or monocots, in that they put out new roots every year. They don't just keep their old roots and those roots keep working. So they actually create a whole new root system every year. The old roots are still there, but they are not very functional. In many cases, they don't functional at all. So warm season grasses are another thing I would not put in late in the season. And I have friends who have a lot of luck with establishing conifers in the fall, but I have not had as much luck, and I think it may be partially because I grow a lot of containerized conifers, and they come in very lightweight bark-based mulch soil mixes, and they just need too much winter watering to keep from drying out because they haven't had time to get their roots out into the native soil. So I tend to, especially with clients, because I don't want them to lose plants, I suffer my own losses in the garden and not worry about it so much. I don't like to plant evergreens late. But deciduous trees, most of your temperate perennials except for the desert plants, and pretty much all your grasses except for the warm season grasses, I agree with you. You can take it pretty much till the ground freezes.
Great. All right. I appreciate you touching on that because I know, especially at this time of year that we're doing this call, it's on people's minds. So thank you. And I would love for you to go on with whatever other points you wanted to make.
Sure. Well, here comes a real, this is a very more controversial one. The idea of mulch in general and the idea of what are the best mulches to use. And again, a lot of that depends on what's available to you, you know, what you feel comfortable using from a sustainability point of view or from a physical point of view. Rock is heavier than, obviously, organic materials to use for mulch. And then even the question of, do we actually have to have mulch all the time? It's kind of come out as a mantra. It's like almost like the Ten Commandments. You're not really doing an intelligent garden if you don't mulch everything. And my experience is that's not necessarily true at all. But if you look at natural plant communities, not all of them have a natural mulch. I mean, in some areas there is a natural stone layer. In some areas there's a natural layer of duff, of old, either old grass duff or, in the case of woodland areas, leaf duff. But in many cases there's just soil between plants. And so I sometimes question the idea that we always have to have a mulch, especially if you plant very closely. So I'm not going to be dogmatic about most of the mulch choices. For woodland plants or shade plants, which tend to be naturally more plants that need more moisture because it can come from regions that are forested, support a forest community, and the plants have evolved beneath the trees, they love to have chopped leaves, shredded leaves, which you can actually just shred with a mower if you want to make your own. And then out in full sun, if you have a kind of a desert type planting, using a lot of subshrubs or big architectural yuccas and agaves and things like that, I think that different types of stone mulches and pea gravel are a very natural mulch. They look very good with that. The question is, do you have any locally available, and do you want to lug them in? Because it is a real heavy work to be carrying 5-gallon buckets of mulch from your driveway or your truck to the garden and spreading them. And then the thing is the bark mulch. This is where I get into arguments with with other horticulturists and people, but I am very firmly against using bark mulch. I have found that it stunts the growth of most herbaceous plants. I find that in some cases it actually, not only is it stealing nitrogen because it's such a high carbon organic material that the microbes need so much nitrogen to break it down, and we have generally nitrogen-poor soils in the West, so they take what little nitrogen is natural in our soil and use that to try to break down the mulches, and then you have nitrogen-starved plants. And you can see them often in these plantings on, you know, at McDonald's or whatever. The classic is like a little daylily that's blooming very hard but is half the normal size. That's like that's a really, I would say, a very classic example of nitrogen starvation. But the other thing for me is that I look at plants in the wild, and there I can't think of any place in the world where there's a plant community where pieces of wood or bark are falling all over the plants and mulching them naturally. It's just not something that happens in nature. And a lot of the mulches that we use are made of what I consider suspect wood. A lot of places chip up old shingles. They chip up wood that has been treated. They also use, I mean, some of the favorite mulches people use are cedar bark mulch because it doesn't break down as quickly. Well, there's a reason it doesn't break down as quickly. It has actually, those trees that it comes from have natural antibacterial, antifungal properties in their bark and in their wood to protect themselves. But they also, what they are, is they're somewhat warfaring compounds that also stunt the growth of other plants. So you putting down cedar bark mulch, you can actually be creating a situation that is slowing the growth and inhibiting the growth of your plants. So I don't know. To me, it just seems like it's an easy thing to do. They're inexpensive. You can find them everywhere. But I think it's kind of a marketing ploy by people because there is so much excess lumber in this country and so much wood byproduct that people have found like, oh, wow, how do we sell this? If we tell people to put them all over their perennials, then we can sell this stuff. And it's become this thing over the last 20 years, whereas when I was first training in horticulture, people weren't doing that, certainly not around perennials. Nobody was putting bark mulch around perennials. They might have put it around the base of trees, basically because they were tired of having the park people who were mowing crashing into their trees while they were mowing and digging them all up. But I never saw the bark mulch used in perennial plantings like I do now, and I don't think it's a good idea.
Wow, I think that's fabulous to hear all that. So many good points about why not to use this extra thing that everyone makes you think you have to buy.
Yeah,
that's really great. Great to hear, because it does make a lot of sense, everything that you just said, Lauren. So thank you for sharing your, as you said, controversial opinions. I love the controversy. I love to get people thinking, so this is great. And for me, it begs the question of what if someone chooses to plant a little more sparsely than is your typical style, where you pack plants in pretty tightly? If people do want to plant their plants further apart where they aren't going to be touching, then there's so much open soil that could, mm-hmm. Dry out, have weeds come in if they don't use the typical bark mulch. What would you say to that?
Well, again, I would say, especially, I think the sparse planting is the most aesthetically successful with the more desert plants. I think planting, daylilies and Shasta daisies sparsely looks really, really strange because they come from a mesic place and they're lush and they grow naturally with other plants basically just piled on top of them. But the desert plants in nature, you will see them more spread out. And that's where I would say you would use rock, because in nature that is the mulch in dry plant communities. You will see rocks. They don't have to be gravel. It could be just a mix of different sizes, or even just taking a beautiful boulder and using that as the mulch for a plant planted right next to it, where it can use that cooler, moister root run hidden underneath the base of that boulder, that's a great way to help that plant grow and also give it something to show it off, and it's actually serving as a mulch. So that's where I would go with that. A lot of people make their own compost, and they actually use that as a seasonal mulch. It breaks down because the microbes have an easy time breaking that because it's down because it has more nitrogen versus the carbon, and in terms of its ratio versus the bark mulch. But there are a lot of plants that don't, especially a lot of the western and desert plants, that aren't ideally mulched regularly with something that rich. I don't think top dressing with compost would be something I would want to do with my most xeric plants. Mm-hmm. But if I was growing sort of your more average moisture plants, like the Shasta daisies or the daylilies, the compost would be a great thing to do, to use. But I would just be very careful if you're not making your own compost. Buying compost is a real Russian roulette, and some places make their own and really do a good job, and other places mix all kinds of things into the compost that actually can be more detrimental to the plants than at helping the plants. So that's something to be very careful about if you're going to be looking out to shop for compost. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I would say compost mulch, leaf mulch, again, rock mulch, all those different things. I would say for the sparse planting, take a cue from nature. Those plants usually have different kinds of rocks mm-hmm. that are used in nature. They're part of that plant community and the soils there.
Yeah. Good. I love the idea of a single attractive boulder as mulch. That's so great. I have to try
well,
that.
It's high drama, and it works really well for the plant and for the gardener to enjoy it.
Yeah, definitely. And this I don't want to spend much time on, but I kind of realized I don't think it's come up anywhere in either of the series that I've done so far interviewing speakers. And there could be people out there wondering. I just kind of make assumptions that people know not to use weed mat, but I don't think everyone knows why not to. Would you offer us just a couple sentences about your opinions about weed mat, Lauren?
Well, there are different kinds of weed mat, and some are more porous to air and moisture than others. So there's better and worse weed mats. I personally feel like that it's not a natural thing to do that. That's not the way the soil works. There's, a soil-air interface and a soil-water interface that you're definitely interfering with by having weed mat. I also think most gardeners, weed mat's really a pain because you can't change your garden. You have to dig a hole every time into that weed mat every time you want to plant a plant. There's actually very different. They have done studies, very different, the soil organisms that are growing in soil underneath weed mat versus just regular soil. The other thing is they found other types of soil organisms growing underneath soil that has mulch on it. So, I mean, all these things change things. So I'm not saying that, change is always bad. When you're mulching the soil, you're also changing the flora that's going to do well in that soil. But I am just not a big proponent of the weed mat for the reason that in most cases, it's not permeable enough, and it doesn't give you the flexibility as a gardener that you want to have. And you're going to put mulch on top of it anyway. And usually after a couple of years, it not only is it not working anymore that well, because all kinds of things have blown in and soil has blown in and the mulch has started breaking down if it's an organic mulch, and things are starting to grow on top of the weed mat, but it looks terrible. And the soil underneath is not getting what it needs. It's not getting the air and the moisture that it would have if it didn't have that layer over it. But the worst thing is the black plastic. That's when I really go ballistic, mm-hmm. because you basically kill your soil with that. Mm-hmm. Because it's anaerobic underneath there. Nothing can live. You basically turn your soil to cement. Mm-hmm.
So let's look to natural solutions rather than the manufactured ones.
Yep.
Yeah, great. Okay, and then speaking of holding in moisture and moisture concerns, I would like you to tell us a little bit about how you go about watering your gardens. You've talked about natural gardens not requiring as much water, but how do you go about getting your gardens established, do you use any sort of drip system? Do you water all by hand? And if so, how often?
Oh, that's a real complex thing, because what I do for my own garden is very different from what I would do for most of my clients.
What do you want to
I'm
teach
willing
us?
To put quite, excuse me?
What do you want
what?
To teach us? What do you want to teach us about how do you
well,
want
I actually
to
don't,
do it?
I don't think there's much I don't want to teach about watering. I think,
okay.
again, it's such an ambiguous thing. I think the first thing to think about is how much do you feel comfortable watering? And that's a moral issue. It's a financial issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a time issue, all those things. So that's the first thing that has to be looked at, and I'm not going to, you know, get on my high horse about it because people are different, and I'm not going to tell a person they can't have a vegetable garden because they need to have a lot of water for it. And I'm not going to tell a person they can't grow a rose because it's not like a yucca. But I also think that people are starting to think about, okay, I'm not going to have an acre full of these water pigs, and I'm going to start thinking about what water pigs I really have to have in my life and which ones I can let go of. But for me myself, I'm not a big proponent of drip systems because I do too much changing in my garden. I do too much adding and you know, moving around and editing, and I think they just are not flexible enough, flexible not physically, but flexible in terms of actually the way I want my garden to work. And so my garden is actually a mix of no water, which the south side is, which is a cactus and succulent and companion garden. And when we have a really bad drought, like we had this summer where we didn't have rain for almost 9 weeks, I will just bring a hose out with a sprinkler on the end and give that a drink. Because even cacti would prefer to have water in the summer maybe once a month than not at all. And then different other parts of the garden. My vegetable garden, I water twice a week during the heat of the summer. And I also water that in the evening with a hose with a sprinkler. I have a big garden around the back, which is basically a chaparral garden around the perimeter, which is a lot of shrubs, trees, lower growing trees, and grasses and large perennials and subshrubs. And there's a drip system on that I use. It's not the typical drip system with individual emitters. It is soaker hoses. And that's really the only version of drip I use in my garden are soaker hoses. I've really found them to be just really a great way to water. And I just run that when I haven't had rain in the back there for three or four weeks. I will run those soaker hoses on those plants because those plants are quite xeric and really can get by for 3 or 4 weeks without any rain or irrigation. And then if, like this summer, we don't have anything for almost 3 months, then I have to intervene because I don't want the plants to suffer. That's what a gardener's supposed to do. I get in arguments with Bob Nold about that. I'm not a Darwinian gardener to the point that I will watch my plant die when I know I could have saved it with just a can of water. So I don't like to do that. I like to tend my plants. So,
yeah.
But basically, so my garden is a mix of really no water, watering, you know, occasionally with soakers, and then watering regularly with actually an overhead sprinkler on a hose, moving the hose around.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Good. Yeah, that helps. There's some flexibility there as far as what we all feel meets our needs, and then there are options within what we choose. So I think that's great. For me, I'm always trying to have minimal maintenance and minimal inputs and still have as much beauty out of that as I can. And, you know, I have really subscribed to a lot of Bob Nold's methods of not really watering very much at all, and I have watched some of my plants die, and then I've tried doing it different ways, and so it's always interesting to hear how you do it and other authors and speakers who have these magnificent
gardens.
Yeah,
well, I lived up in the foothills, and I was reliant on a well at that
mm-hmm.
garden, and we went through a serious drought in 2000, 2001, and 2002, and our well ran dry each summer. And we had to bring in water just for domestic use. And so my gardens were not watered then. I kept some of my nursery plants alive and my container plants, and I did periodically use some of the domestic water we hauled in for a few of our fruit trees. But basically everything else just went through the drought. And I lost most of my garden, even natives. Most of the penstemons and areognums died. All the bulbs died because they didn't get any kind of moisture even in the winter. And most bulbs actually need to have moisture in the winter for their roots because their roots are actively growing in the fall and winter. And so it was really interesting to see, you know, what was left after 3 years of drought. And it made me realize that the idea of really subscribing to a no-water garden in the West limits your gardening so much that I would move because I wouldn't want to see the plants look that bad, and I wouldn't want to be limited to waiting for the penstemons to come back from seed, which is what happens in nature. When there's big droughts, a lot of our herbaceous native plants will die, but the seed bank will come back. But you know what? I have another 20, 30 years in my life, and I really don't want to do it that way. So, you know, my feeling is that water is a necessity to garden out here in any kind of a way that I consider interesting and beautiful and all that. I just think we can definitely limit what the water we're using and use it more wisely and intelligently. But I don't subscribe to the idea, and I get very worried when people are saying we really need to get to zero water gardening. And I'm kind of like, okay, I'm willing to take one shower a week to have more water for my garden. I don't care. That's more important to me. I will never wash my car again. In fact, I never do wash my car. So I feel like we should be able to use water for what we care for. Mm-hmm. And I have a shade tree that is keeping my house cool, and we don't have water for a month. I'm going to go out there and water it, and they can chain me to that tree and call me off to jail before I'll quit doing that.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty, you know, I can get pretty on my high horse about that. I do feel like there are extremes. We've gone from using too much water to some people being so extreme that they're saying you should not have a landscape that needs extra water. And, I mean, you can say that in Indiana, but I just think it's not very fair to say that in the arid West.
Mm-hmm.
We should always have some portion of water available for our plants, especially things like shade trees.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's beautiful what you just said. And I want to let you down off your high horse and say you're just passionate about it. That's all it is. And that's wonderful. And that's why you are who you are and people know who you are. And you write these amazing books that help people. So kudos to you. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. And before we go on to talking a little bit more about your books and resources that people can learn more from you from, are there any other last points that you would like to make about how people can create a natural garden?
Well, I guess there was one thing I had mentioned earlier about, you know, trying to have a garden that has less input. And I mentioned there's output is also a part of that picture, and people don't tend to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm talking about is that a lot of us are, you know, really enamored of perennials. I mean, perennials have become, you know, they've come so much on the forefront the last two decades. And we have a really great climate for growing so many different perennials, whether they're Mesic or Xeric. The issue with that is that many of those plants have to be cut down every year, and you wind up with an inordinate amount of plant waste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time-consuming. And then the question is, do you have a place to compost it? Are you hauling it off the landfill? Does your town have some kind of a composting place you can take this refuse to? And I think a lot of us have to look at our gardening practices and how much of that waste we create and what we can do with it. And that's not really been discussed a lot. You know, in nature, these things either rot. If they are perennials from moisture climates, they tend to just turn to slime in the winter on their own. We don't have enough moisture in our climate here to do that, so they kind of freeze dry, which makes them very beautiful in the winter, but then you've got that stuff to cut down in the spring. If they are dryland plants, you know, that they will either burn or they actually, you know, if it's an ecology where there's burning, or they get browsed, or the heat of the sun in the summer actually just disintegrates what's left over from the year before. And in much of where we, you know, grow things here, at least in Colorado where I live, none of those things happen naturally in the garden anymore. There's no buffalo grazing. There's no fires burning. You know, it's not wet enough for things to rot naturally. So you've got a lot of debris. So I think that thinking about plants that create less debris, lots of the shrubs, a lot of the desert plants that are architectural like yuccas, a lot of our evergreen plants, whether they're trees, shrubs, or perennials that have evergreen foliage, things like that, those are plants that don't create as much, you know, seasonal annual waste. And that's something that people need to start looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point once again. And I would like to throw in there rock gardens. In my experience, my rock garden doesn't create nearly as much waste as the other parts of my perennial garden. Would you?
Yep. That's because
that?
So many of those plants are smaller and evergreen,
yeah,
and low-growing, you know, mat formers that keep their foliage, you know, even if it is deciduous, there's not so much of it. And then you have a lot of the area covered by rocks. So, yeah, totally. I have the same experience. My rock garden hardly makes any kind of annual mess. My main mess is that there's leaves blowing in from the neighbors that get stuck in it that,
yep,
I have to pull out every spray.
Yep, there's always something, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'll just throw out there that to our audience that we did have a really great talk with Bill Adams about rock gardens and rock garden plants in a previous series, and so that could be looked up on AbundantEarthGardens.com website if you're interested in learning more about it.
Bill's great. Bill is an amazing grower. He has, for those of you who don't know, he has a nursery where he grows really rare and unusual smaller stature plants that are in most cases very xeric and well adapted to the soils of the West.
And low waste producing. Right?
Excuse me?
And low,
say what?
Low waste producing.
Yeah, they are low,
yeah,
waste producing for sure.
Yeah, great. Great. Well, I would love to hear a little bit about your books, Lauren, if you want to just give us a brief rundown on the books that you've written by yourself and then with your husband and what you feel people have to gain from those books in the West. I know some of them apply to people well beyond the West. They could be anywhere. But if you could speak directly to our listening audience in the West as to their interest in your books, I'd love that.
Oh, great, Ava. So I have to be my own PR person. Okay.
Well, I've read some of them, but you know them better than I.
Well, my first book was The Undaunted Garden, and it came out almost 20 years ago, and I just redid that, as Ava mentioned at the beginning of the program. It's basically almost a new book, but it's the most personal of my books. It really talks about all the things that I've learned, all the plants I've killed, and my evolution as a gardener, and it's a very plant-rich book, and it's based specifically on my experience gardening in Colorado. It's really been a useful book for many people, but also kind of it seems to have been an inspirational book for many people because I talked about all the struggles and all the things I didn't know about gardening here, and I had to learn them the hard way. And so that I still feel is, you know, my flagship book and really is who I am as a gardener and as a person, and also has, you know, 30 years of gardening, 25 years of which were in the West, wrapped up in it. And then my husband, Scott, who's also a horticulturist and garden designer out of Texas, we've written some books together now. And the first book we did together came out 4 years ago now. It's called Plant Driven Design. And it's actually a book that's not just for the West. It was geared to a national public, national audience. And it's really about design ideas and very much about the idea of natural gardens as well. We talk a lot about what we think is wrong with horticulture today and with design especially. And what I really love this book. It took us 3 years and almost killed our marriage, but we managed to slog through it. And what I find really interesting about this book is that it has got passionately positive and passionately negative reviews. So I never thought horticulture could be so controversial, but it has really raised the hackles of people or made them very, very excited. And at first I took that really personally. I thought, oh, my God, how could a person hate this book so much? Why are they so angry at me? And I think it's because Scott and I really, we expressed our opinions about things we weren't happy about. And I guess it ruffled some feathers, and when we slayed some sacred cows, that I guess in some people's hearts weren't ready to be slain. Mm-hmm. So if you, you know, want to look at a book and read a book that has gotten a lot of passion out of its readers, and both positive and negative, I think that we're very proud of it. It's a unique book. There's really nothing else like it. Mm-hmm. And the last book we did together just came out last year, and it's really much more of a guidebook for beginning gardeners. It's kind of almost like a shopping book you take with you. And it's basically about sustainable plants, water-wise plants for sustainable gardens is what it's called. It's a paperback of 200 plants for all different parts of the country, and each plant is, we describe and tell, you know, what regions is most best suited to, and then we talk about 400 other plants within the context of each of these other plants that are similar and also interesting to look at. So basically you get suggestions for about 600 water-wise sustainable plants for gardens. And it's just a very easy book to look at. You don't have to read a lot. It's all bulleted. It tells you the hardiness, what it might want to grow with, design ideas, what kind of pollinators it attracts, whether it's deer resistant, just all the basics you might want to know about a plant. So that's been kind of our most simple and grocery kind of list type of book that's really useful for people who are just starting out.
Thank you, Lauren. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm sure that it's interesting for people to hear you talk about your books and what you see as the highlights than a bystander. Yeah, I appreciate that, and I have very much enjoyed the books of yours that I have read and refer back to them frequently. So thank you for your contribution to horticulture in the West, and thank you so much for being with us today. It has been such a true delight to be able to chat with you like this and bring your voice out to so many other people who have read your words. But, you know, it's so much more fun to get to hear the intonation that you use when you talk and get to know you as a person a little bit.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I'm really thrilled that you're even doing this, Ava. It's just such a different way for people to learn more about gardening in this region. I think it's just a great idea, and I hope that lots and lots and lots of people are listening to what you put out, all the different cool people that you've already had on this program.
Yes, thank you so much. And with that, we will bid you farewell and look forward to next time we cross your paths. Thank you so much, Lauren. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.